This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Margaret Maron has been writing mystery novels for more than two decades. Her longest series is about a North Carolina district judge named Deborah Knott. Margaret's latest title, Long Upon the Land, is the 20th and final novel in the series. Going to be a launch party at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh on Tuesday at 7, and then she's going to be back at Quail Ridge August 19th for a book signing. And Margaret Maron joins us now to talk about her latest, Long Upon the Land. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
It's always a pleasure, but apparently I will never have you back for another Deborah Knott novel.
Sorry about that.
Tell us about this one.
Well, as you said, it is the final one. I decided that it's not that I'm tired of Deborah Knott and her family, but that I feel like I have said everything that was valid to say about them. And the title of this one, Long Upon the Land, is sort of a meditation about what the land means to different people, to her family, and also to people who feel that they were dispossessed of their land. And it comes from the commandment, honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God has given thee.
This, the place, and North Carolina in particular, yeah. Does play an important part. I think it's fair to say it's a character in this book.
Mm-hmm. Some of the things that I raised in the very first book or two that I wrote about Deborah Knott, for instance, I mentioned a cigarette lighter that had belonged to her mother, Sue Stevenson, and that it was important. But I never really said why, and I didn't really care. It was just something to throw in about the fact that her mother had died of lung cancer. And over the years, readers have asked me, what about that cigarette lighter? What is the story behind it? Also, I was curious as to how a woman like Sue Stevenson, who was the daughter of a fairly well-to-do small-town attorney whose friends thought he should run for governor. She would have been a debutante had the war not interfered, the Second World War, we're talking, and a backwoods illiterate bootlegger. How did they get together? How did that marriage work? And it was a very successful, warm, loving marriage. And so in this book, I do flashbacks to 1945 and show how they met and how it was inevitable that they would marry.
And in this book as well, Deborah Knott's family is implicated in the
yes.
story. They're very deeply involved.
Yes, the present-day murder mystery has to do with someone who once owned the farm, owned part of the farm. Kezie Knott is one of those things who's sort of like the old Cold War Russians. You could never have enough land around you. You kept buying. Anytime a single acre of land would come on the market, he was right there with his wallet open, trying to put more and more land between him and the rest of the world.
And as I say, the implication is that there has been a murder, but the mm-hmm. but the family had a beef with the victim's family, and
yes.
there's a suggestion that
yes.
that the sheriff in this case, Deborah's husband, is pulling punches.
That's right. That he probably should recuse himself and not even be the one investigating, because the small local newspaper implies that, yes, that Dwight is pulling his punches, that he is not questioning them as carefully. But, of course, I think he feels like that no way could they be the killer.
I'm a professional, and I'm doing my job. Maybe could I ask you to read for us? You set up maybe
sure.
and set the scene
one
for
of the things I'll set this up a little bit by saying that Deborah's mother, Sue, used to tease Kezie that she fell in love with the little boys. He was a widower with eight small boys.
Because he's her bootlegger husband.
The bootlegger husband. Mm. That she fell in love with the little boys before she fell in love with him. Because she was out at in the country one day in December and heard two of the little boys playing out on the creek that had frozen, and they fell through the ice, and she pulled them out. So the next day she goes out with a canister of Christmas candy, and she finds the two of the boys, rolling on the ground in furious fight. Frank, the older one, was ready to kill his brother, Andrew. And she says, you know, why? And he said, well, Andrew had destroyed their mother's footprints. And he pulls Sue into the wash house to show her. There, says Frank, And his lower lip quivers again as he points to a spot beneath the window, just under the edge of the counter. Sue can see the outline of where the round pan must have been pressed into the dirt before it was dragged from its resting place. Multiple footprints of all sizes crisscross the dirt floor, but that spot under the counter is wiped smooth. "It was Mama's footprints," he said, his voice quavering again. "Last time she did the wash, right before she went to the house to have Jack. I come in here after the burying, and there was her footprints, and I put the dishpan over them so I'd always have them. And then Andrew went, and I hate him. I hate him, and I'll hate him forever. Now she's really grown, gone. Now she's really all gone," he moans, and her heart breaks for him. When he's cried himself out, she says, "Listen, Frank, her footprints may not be there exactly as she left them, but they aren't really gone. But they is, Miss Sue, see? The shape, maybe, but not the substance." "What substance?" "What things are made of. Your mama's footprints were made in the dirt, and the dirt's still there. See where the pan piled up a little ridge of dirt before Andrew lifted it off?" He gives a doubtful nod. "That's where your mama's footprints still are. Not in the same shape, maybe, but still the substance that she stood on. Wait right here and don't touch it, okay?" So she goes out and she gets the canister and she brings it back in and starts to scoop the dirt up. "I'll do it," Frank said. So she sits back and holds the canister while he gently scoops up the dry dirt as solemnly as if something of his dead mother really is being poured into the tin. When he's satisfied that he saved all the dirt her feet had touched, Sue snaps the lid back on and hands the canister to him. "And if Andrew touches it, I'll kill him," he says fiercely.
Margaret Maron reading from her latest novel, Long Upon the Land. She's going to be at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh at 7 o'clock. And if you miss her then, she's going to be back on the 19th for a book signing. But she's here on The State of Things today. So when you bring these characters now into the scene from Sue's past, her mother's mm-hmm. past, had these, the children, right, of her widowed husband, had they been sort of rattling about the whole time, or did they come to life for book 20 for you?
Oh, no, they've been around the whole time. I mean, we know from the beginning that Deborah is the youngest and 12th of her father's children and the only girl. There are 11 older brothers, and part of the older brothers are these 8 that started off, that Sue became their mother, their stepmother, but really their mother. I mean, they all loved her by the time it was over with.
When you get to this one and you make it your final, you've decided that mm-hmm. this will be the final in this particular series, do you feel like there are a lot of loose ends like that cigarette lighter that you have to
No,
have to
because
tie
we
up?
do find out about the cigarette lighter.
Right.
We find out what the importance was, who owned it, and why it made a difference, and why it probably helped influence Sue to put convention aside and marry the man that she married.
You were born and raised on a tobacco farm in North Carolina.
Yes.
You're still living there now. And so North Carolina is a big part of your blood, although you did a whole series on New York City police when
yes.
you were living up there. How much do you do research on New York, on North Carolina, or do you just sort of write what you felt growing up?
I think it's both, Frank. When I take her out of Colleton County, which is her home county, when I send her across the state, which is why I made her a district court judge, so that I could look at the whole state, I wanted to see what was happening in our state at this time in our history. And this was a way to do it. So when I send her off to a different part of the state, yes, I do a lot of research. I talk to people. I read the local newspapers. I go online and I look for their newspapers. And I will go and talk to the people. And I will say, tell me what the issues are. Why would somebody murder somebody mm-hmm. in your particular area? And people have been extremely generous that way. They have told me so much about the state.
Well, I know you took her to High Point at one point, mm-hmm. and you went there to learn about the furniture
the
market.
The furniture
Tell
market,
us about that
yeah.
experience.
That just blew my mind. I had no idea that the furniture market was that important in North Carolina. I mean, I knew we made furniture, but I didn't know about the market per se. It's the same with going to Ashboro and Seagrove and learning about the potters. I mean, I knew vaguely that there was pottery done, but I didn't know any of the details. And people have just been so great about showing me inside, behind the scenes, taking me into the furniture warehouses and the showrooms, for the pottery, making me get my hands dirty, as they said, and showing me how something is fired in a kiln.
Can I get you to read for us again?
Yeah. In this particular scene, Kezzy Knott has come to town to return the blankets that Sue wrapped the boys in after pulling them out of the water. And as he turns to leave, Sue follows him out into the chilly air and closes the door behind her. "Mr. Knott, wait. I want to apologize for what I said out there at the creek. I was so frightened by what almost happened to Frank and Robert that I spoke out of turn. I had no right to question the way you take care of them or to assume they're neglected because they wandered off." He keeps walking. "They ain't town boys, Miss Stevenson, and they ain't yard dogs to be kept on a chain. They didn't wander off. They got the freedom of the whole farm, and they know where the boundaries are. But they could have been drowned." He turns at that, and his blue eyes bore coldly into hers. "They say you scared them into bolting. Was they lying to me?" Her own eyes drop as she realizes that she probably did startle them. "But what if I'd been a bear?" she argues. "That would have scared them even more." He suddenly grinned. "Would have scared me, too, because there ain't been no bears in Colleton County in 40 years. He gets into his truck and drives away, leaving her both smiling and confused. But when she returns to the house, her mother is not smiling. "What on earth possessed you to let that roughneck drive you home?" she asks angrily. "And in such a vehicle, what will people think?" "Sorry, Mother. What if he'd been a criminal or tried to molest me?" she asks innocently. "Really, Sue?" She's saved by the telephone bell. It's Philip Johnson. "Friends are putting together a caroling party tonight, and he invites her to go with him." "I'd love to," she says. Philip never confuses her.
Margaret Maron, reading from Long Upon the Land, the 20th and the final in the series of the Deborah Knott series. You talked about the fact that you really felt it was time to end the series.
Yes.
You'd written all you can. Was it, when you got to that last page, was it tough to say goodbye to Deborah?
In a way, but as I said earlier, I wanted to leave. I think this book is as good as any of the others, and I wanted to go out on a high note. I didn't want to keep writing and be like a cow chewing the same cud over and over, the same thing. I've had a wonderful time with her. The readers have been very responsive. But, you know, everything comes to an end. So.
When you do a series, and they're extremely popular, all of your series are popular, and they are series. You have a recurring character. You do 20 books, and you say, well, you don't want to sort of chew over the same material over and over. And yet some part of it has to be recognizable, right? What part is sort of the form for you, and what part is the innovation? How do you balance those things?
Well, the form for me is always character. I start with character, and I put the characters into a situation, and then I sort of watch to see what happens. I don't outline. I've never been able to outline. I get bored if I know what's going to happen. So I put the characters in a situation, and then I just wait to see what happens and what develops. I must admit that sometimes I bring her daddy in, when might not be totally necessary, but readers like him
just
so
like
much.
The guy, right?
They really do
bring
like him
in.
So much. He's such an old reprobate. And long ago, I had readers who were worried about the fact that he was in his 80s, and they said, please, promise you'll never kill him off. So if I kept writing, I would have to kill him off, and I made a promise that I wouldn't.
You could send him to Florida. He could drink from the fountain of youth and stay with you forever, as we do in public radio. That's
yes.
What we do for us. So tell me now about the – what's interesting, too, is you talk about wanting to know about North Carolina, what's going on, what are the issues. Mm-hmm. You've actually tackled some deal with some political issues in your books, right?
Oh, yes. Racial issues, political issues. Deborah is a political character. She is a district court judge. She does have to run for office. Now, they have tried to say that judges no longer have a political stance and you don't run on a party. But that doesn't mean that people don't know where you stand, whether you are conservative or liberal or whatever. So, I have every time that I give her a political viewpoint, though, I have a lot of readers who say, that's not why I read a murder mystery, but it's why I write them.
Well, you get some feedback. It's interesting. I notice a couple of times you will actually say, when you're describing a character, you'll describe them as white.
Yes, yes. That was very interesting to me. Nobody ever said anything. No copy editor, no reader ever said anything about identifying a character as being Hispanic or speaking Spanish or being Oriental or Asian, I guess is the proper term. Nobody ever said anything. But as soon as I started saying the white doctor or the white secretary or the white deputy, all of a sudden, even the copy editor was saying, why is white necessary? Why do you have to say white? Because I don't want people to think that the default race is always white.
Yeah, and they've just demonstrated that they did, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's the point that even the copy editors, that's the ground we walk on. And so when you talk about things like profiling and some of these other issues that people don't feel a particular conscious animus about, there it is.
Yeah.
Why did
and
you call
them
white?
And when I say white, that brings them up short, although that's you're not necessarily supposed to bring your readers up short. But as I say, I have other axes to grind, too. And so if I bring the reader up short and make them think, wait a minute, why am I bothered by the fact that she said this is a white character? Then maybe it's starting to seep in.
Well, you have this. Deborah Knott is now at the end of her career. You've won the Longleaf Pine Award in North Carolina and many, many, many other literary awards. And I know you're going to continue writing.
Yes.
This is not the end of your career. But as you look back now at this kind of pivotal moment, what's the biggest accomplishment for you and the biggest, maybe the biggest accolade?
Oh, gosh. There's so much. I have been so fortunate to come into the field at the time that I did when women were starting to make a difference, when publishers were paying attention to women writers. I guess one of the things that I'm proudest of having done has been one of the founders of Sisters in Crime, which was an organization which was trying to level the playing field for women writers. I don't know. I've just had I've been very lucky with my friendships and with being here at this time in this place. And it's been a great career. I've been very lucky to be able to do what I want to do and to have people that will read the books and publishers who will give me money for it so that I don't have to punch a time clock, per se. And that's another reason for not wanting to write anymore. I don't want any more deadlines. I mean, I'm not going to sign it. I'm going to write, but I'm going to write on my schedule.
Well, what are you going to be writing?
Well, I actually am going to write another Sigrid Harrell book. The New York detective. There's one more thing or two that I want to say about her. And then I will go back to the short stories. That's how I started, with short stories. And I can be different characters and play with different characters in the short story form. And I'm not limited to a set of fixed characters in a series.
Will there be mysteries?
Yes.
The short stories?
Oh, yes, yes.
Well, we'll have you back for all of those as well. You're given the keynote address of the North Carolina Library Association, right?
Yes.
They're coming up, so we'll catch you in a couple of different places.
Hope
and
so.
Have you back for your next work. But Margaret Maron, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Frank.
Margaret Maron, a mystery writer who has been publishing for more than two decades. Her latest title, Long Upon the Land, is the 20th and final novel in the Deborah Knott series. Margaret's going to be at a launch party at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, 7 o'clock on Tuesday, and then she is going to be back at Quail Ridge August 19th for a book signing, and you can find out all that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Bill Maher is just ahead on the State of Things. He's going to be at the DPAC this weekend. He talks with us before that on the State of Things. Please stay tuned.